So we'll put the little handout I gave you, we will put that up on the website as well, so the people that listen will have something they can print off and put in their Bible. One thing that's important to keep in mind, and I know it's hard when we go through short chunks of especially a letter like 1 Peter, where Peter has the world's longest sentences. I mean, he's not really a scholar, and the sentences, Tony was saying on last night that they need semicolons or commas or some place to breathe when you're reading them. But it's easy to lose the overarching picture, and I think that it would be wise to go all the way back to chapter 2, verse 21, which I believe is the key to everything that Peter is saying, all the way up to actually past where we're going to be today, actually all the way through most of the letter. Peter tells us that when we are suffering for doing the right thing, when we make a commitment to follow, to obey the Lord, to trust in Him, and that brings suffering, that we need to keep in mind that that's what we were called to. And then he says what we were called to was Jesus left a template, a pattern for us, in that that's the way he lived his life. And that thought, I think, is carried all the way through tonight. And in the midst of some wonderful things, and there are a couple of rabbit trails, I give you warning that I think they're worth going down, especially the first one. But in the middle of this is one of the most difficult passages in all of the New Testament, and I am not exaggerating. Peter's Greek is not very good. It's the worst Greek in all of the New Testament, and so the Greek scholars who are used to being able to just chase down words and analyze grammar and syntax and everything to sort of, you know, work their way out of linguistic difficulties, even they have problems with this, and I'm certainly not a scholar. Peter just goes off somewhere, and nobody seems to really know why and where it is that he's going, but he does come back. And in the past, I have gotten slogged down in trying to fight my way through the couple of controversial verses in the middle of this and not give the right amount of time to the important things that are clear and obvious. And so pray for me that I will not do that tonight. I did hear Chuck one time teach this passage, and I was waiting to get answers from my pastor, and he read right through the controversial stuff and never said one word, never said one word, just kept right on going. And I thought, man, I wish I had the nerve to do that. So maybe I will tonight. We stopped with Peter saying last week to keep a clear conscience in our relations with other people, but notably unbelievers, and especially unbelievers that are making our lives difficult. And he said, always be ready, prepared, to give an answer to anybody that asks you the reason for the hope that you have, because sometimes it comes in odd places, and I told you some interesting stories from my own life and observation about sometimes you think nobody's listening, sometimes you think it's you just want to fire back, you know, and lo and behold, somebody shows that they have an open heart and you wouldn't have had a clue. So be prepared. And when you give the answer, Peter says in verse 15, he says, be sure that you do it with gentleness and respect. That is something that evangelical Christians are not famous for. If you were to ask the average pagan, let's just say here, where we live. I found this is true just about everywhere, but if you were to ask the average pagan, give me two adjectives that describe evangelical Christians, I would bet you that probably gentleness and respectfulness would not be at the top of the list, because we have a tendency to be short and disrespectful and even pushy. And Peter says, you know, don't do that. Keep a clear conscience on that issue. So we're going to pick up at verse 17. I'm going to read all the way through verse 6 of chapter 4. And the reason we're not stopping at the end of chapter 3 is because of the very first word in chapter 4 is that big fat word, therefore. And you Bible students know that when you see therefore, then you need to find out what it's there for, because it's telling you that there's connectedness between what's just been said and what's been said, what is about to be said. And so I will begin reading right after he says in verse 16, keep a clear conscience so that people are bad-mouthing your Christian behavior are going to be ashamed and find out that they're really not telling the truth about you. Verse 17, chapter 3, 1 Peter. It is better if it is God's will. And that's a fatter phrase than you think. So underline that. It's better if it's God's will to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. Because Christ died for sins once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous. And the word for is an important transitional word there, so circle that. He died for sins once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. Talk about suffering for the sake of someone else. That's the ultimate. He was put to death in the body, but made alive by the Spirit. Brace yourself. Here comes Peter starting to lose control of his automobile and wander all over the road. Through whom, that is through the Spirit, also he went and preached to the spirits in prison who disobeyed long ago when God waited patiently, or the patience of God waited is closer to, as awkward as it is in English, it's closer to the Greek. The patience of God waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being built. In it, the ark, only a few people, eight in all, were saved through water. Hang on, strap yourselves in. And this water is a picture of or symbolizes baptism that now saves you also, not the removal of dirt from the body, but the response of a good conscience toward God. My NIV says the pledge of a good conscience. That's not a great translation of the Greek word. Response is better. Answer is what the King James, the New King James said. So, baptism, which now saves you also, not the removal of dirt from the body, but the answer or response of a good conscience toward God. It saves you by the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is now, right this minute, at God's right hand, with angels and authorities and powers in submission to him. Therefore, since Christ suffered in his body, arm yourselves also with the same attitude. Because he who has suffered in his body, that is, suffered for Christ or suffered for doing the right thing, because that's the theme, he who has suffered in his body for Christ is done with sin. And that's an awkward phrase that doesn't exactly mean what it might appear on the surface, so it's worthy of being underlined. As a result, he doesn't live the rest of the person who suffered physically for Jesus or for doing what's right. As a result, he doesn't live the rest of his earthly life for evil human desires, but rather for the will of God. You spent enough time in the past doing what pagans choose to do, living in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and detestable idolatry, and they think it strange that you do not plunge with them still, is the implied, that you're still not like that. You don't plunge with them in the same flood of dissipation, and they heap abuse on you, but they will have to give account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. And this is the reason the gospel was preached even to those who are dead or who have died, so that they might be judged according to men in regard to the body, but live according to God in regard to the spirit. And we'll stop there. It's very hard to follow. I think it's probably the most awkward passage in certainly to me in all of the New Testament. However, if I can get past the awkwardness and we can track together on this, there's some wonderful things in here. There are a couple of rabbit trails. There's a rabbit trail about Noah, which I want to go down simply because we talked about that Sunday. I certainly didn't plan. And every time that works out, I'm thinking, you know, maybe God's trying to tell us something. Remember on Sunday, we quoted Matthew 24, where Jesus said, the way that it was in the days of Noah is the way that it's going to be at the coming of the Son of Man. So anytime we have an opportunity to look at anything about those days, I think that was as a good heads up. But let's start back at verse 17. And I will admit, we're sort of going to start out with, it's not really a rabbit trail. But I saw a connection between verse 17 and verse 1 and 2 of chapter 4. And it lies in the area of going all the way back to chapter 2, verse 21, which is the key verse in this whole passage about God's intention, what he called us to, his number one agenda item in our growth. Remember, our salvation isn't the end, it's the beginning. Some people think, well, I got fire insurance, stick it in my hip pocket, okay, I'm good to go. Now, if I die, I go to heaven. But no, that's not God's idea. When he gives us new life, that's a growing thing. And God's intention is to grow us up in every way to resemble Jesus. Jesus is the model, if you will, of the perfect human. He is what God had in mind for humans to be. And God comes into our lives, that growing thing that's planted in us, which the Bible calls new life. God intends for it to grow up to be just like Jesus. I think lots of times we misunderstand what he's up to. And if we don't have that in our mind, and if we're not looking to Jesus as our model, it can be confusing. And in fact, I know people that give up because they think God's mad at them, and they don't understand that he's producing something in them that can only be produced in that particular way. One of those areas is the area of suffering. Peter is writing this whole passage to people who just living out their Christian lives and the culture that they were in with Caesar Nero at the helm of the number one civilization in the world, the biggest madman who made Hitler look like a choir boy. Nero was insane and bent on destroying Christianity. Interesting that despite how many hundreds of thousands of Christians that he killed, Christianity flourished and grew. So Peter is writing this whole passage to give perspective to people who made a commitment to Jesus and don't really understand the way the plot line is unfolding all the time. And boy, perspective is so important. I have seen things that I was fighting against or things that I thought God was angry at me, and when I began to see them with from the right perspective, what he was up to, I realized he was doing wonderful things. I just didn't understand that's the way you get from point A to point B in God's economy. The phrase I had you underline in verse 17 that I think is the springboard for this rabbit trail is, where am I here? It's hard to read my Bible because when I spilled the water all over it, it soaked the pages and smeared the ink. It is better if it's God's will to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. That's sort of a no-brainer, isn't it? Look, if you're going to suffer, let it be because you did a good thing, not because you did a bad thing. And as duh as that is, I grew up in a church that in a denomination in the olden days that was very, very pushy, very obnoxious. The kind of people where people would get on a bullhorn and stand up on a city bus and yell at people and tell them they were going to hell and that kind of a thing. And you sort of shrink down in your seat and hope nobody realizes that you go to that same church that those people go to. And when people would cuss at us or, you know, throw rotten tomatoes at the church, we would say, well, thank God we're persecuted for righteousness' sake. And you know what? We were persecuted because we were obnoxious. And there's no blessing in that. Peter's already said that. Look, if you're suffering because you're a lousy worker, you know, that's not commendable. If you're doing your best and you suffer for that, well, that's part of the Christian life, and Jesus is a model of how you deal with that. The phrase I wanted you to look at is the "if it is God's will." I've asked a number of persons. I have to admit it is sort of a trick question because I know the answer. When I've already asked the question, I talked to somebody today about it. Because I'm asked the question a lot, and I pass it on to see what people think. Why, if God is good, if God is loving, why does he allow good people to suffer? We know why he allows bad people to suffer. In fact, we've invented whole theologies in this country that say that if you're a good person, you never will suffer. If you're a really good Christian, all suffering is gone from your life. And I'm thinking, well, you're going to have to cut big holes in your Bible because it has a lot to say about good people suffering. Why? Well, the answer I usually get is, well, it's a fallen world. And, you know, it's just that's the world that we live in. And, you know, you're swimming against the current. It's hostile territory. So if you're doing good, you're going to draw fire. And that's why God allows suffering. But this statement is a different kind of statement. And it stopped me in my tracks in my life. And like God often does, he had already set me up to teach me what now I look back on and think was one of the most important lessons I ever learned in my life. And who I am today has a lot to do with a certain fork in the road that I came to on the issue of, Peter says more than once in here, he uses the term God's will for you to suffer. That's different than God allowing you to suffer, because the word for will means a deliberate choice. A desire that God has, a decision that God makes. The God who can choose to make suffering go away, which he frequently does, is the same God that for certain specific reasons, and they're good reasons, what I call in your little handout, an indispensable lesson in becoming like Jesus. Sometimes God chooses that we would suffer. Why is that? Well, if we're going to look at Jesus as our model, I wrote down on your little handout sheet a verse from Hebrews chapter 5. I have to tell you, I've never heard any right-on teaching on this. I have heard some bad teaching on it on the radio, and I wanted to scream because I couldn't raise my hand and say, wait a minute, that's not what it says. Hebrews 5:8 says that though Jesus was a son, he learned obedience through the things that he suffered. Here's the way I've heard it taught on the radio, a couple of different guys. If I wasn't driving, I would have made an irate phone call. But they said, well, the way we learn obedience through suffering is when we disobey, we suffer. Duh. I mean, that's, but I'm going, but I wanted to scream and say, that's not what Hebrews 5:8 is talking about. Jesus never disobeyed. So you can't apply that principle to what it's saying in Hebrews 5. It's saying something else. Three things converged at this time in my life. It was a fork in the road of enormous proportions for me. It changed the whole way I view my life. It cleared up a lot of misunderstanding as well. I have never deliberately, up till that point, ever chosen the path of pain. if I could find a pain-free path that sort of headed in sort of the same direction, I always took the way of the least pain or the way of the least resistance. That was my pattern. And of course, I did want to be like Jesus. And there's the clash right there, isn't there? God brought me to a place in my life. Like I said, three things converged. One, I was reading Hebrews. I was studying Hebrews. I came across this verse. The same day I came across this verse, I was confronted with I came to an absolute standstill of a fork in the road in my life where I had to make a choice between two different things. God didn't force me which choice to make. I call it a fork in the road. He didn't tell me what to do. I just knew in my heart that the way I was supposed to take, that down that road there was pain. Down the other road was less pain. It wasn't a choice between good and evil. Those kind are easy. We'll see, do I beat up an old lady or, you know, do I share Jesus with somebody? You know, I don't have to make those kind of choices. Those are no-brainers, okay? In fact, here's the other complicated thing. I could take the painful way and nobody would know but me and God. I could take the pain-free way and nobody would know between me and God. And I'm standing at this fork in the road and I knew which one he wanted me to take. And here's the way he dealt with it. Remember, this is the same day I read this passage from Hebrews. And I remember I was forced to have to take one way. I could not any longer just sit there. I won't go into all the details. But so I remember I cried out to the Lord and I said, Lord, Lord. And here's what he said to me. He said, well, son, what are you going to do? He let me face a decision between what was sure pain. As far as I could see, as far down that road, that was going to be probably the worst pain I'd ever experienced in my life up till that point. And nobody would know but between me and him. I know I'm being vague, but you don't need to know all the details. He brought me to that place. Let me make the choice. Didn't influence that choice at all. In fact, I could have made a different choice and nobody would have known. Those are where character is formed, by the way. Those things where you choose against your flesh, where you choose what you know is right and nobody's there to applaud you. There's no standing ovation. There's no ticker tape parade. In fact, I was pretty sure that I was going to suffer and nobody was even going to know how noble I was. I hate that. God was doing something. I think he was doing something that now I see was to bring me closer to him than I'd ever been, and to actually conform me to the image of his son in a way that I'd never allowed him to do. Coincidentally, I was reading a book in the evenings by a man named John Wenham called The Goodness of God. And this particular chapter, he was talking about, if there's a good God, why would he allow people to suffer? You know, what good is there in suffering? That was sort of the main theme. And that same day that I was forced to have to make that choice, by the way, I chose the way of pain. First time in my life, I'd faced that choice in a similar way, many times. I always chose the way of least resistance. First time in my life, I deliberately chose a way that I knew was going to lead to pain. But I knew it was what God wanted me to do. So that evening in John Wenham's book, the very first words I read, not the first words, but in the first paragraph, was the second little quote on this sheet. He was talking about what it is that God wants from us. And of course, he used the example of parents, and I couldn't relate to it because I've never been a parent. I do understand for the people that I love. I understand as a pastor a little bit because it's a little bit like parenting, only if they're all adults. But I understood that for the people I love, I want them to be people who make the decision to do the right thing.